supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to this special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. I'm producer Larry Roebling. From time to time, Dr. Dan returns to talk about issues in behavioral health and what's on his mind. He's been thinking about the field of psychiatry and psychology over the near four decades of his professional journey. He wanted to have a conversation about mental health between professionals at different points in their careers. He asked fellow seasoned veteran, Penn psychiatrist Anthony Rostain, to join him, as well as two young up-and-coming residents. The two generations shared insights in front of a live studio audience. To get the conversation started, Dr. Dan began with his favorite clip from comedian Jackie Mason at a psychiatrist's office. In addition to being funny, it's a reflection of what people thought about psychiatry 40 years ago.
I didn't know who I was. I went to a psychiatrist. I did. He took a look at me right away. He said, "This is not you. This is not me. Then who is it?" He said, "I don't know either." I said, "Then what do I need you for?" He said, "To find out who you are." He said, "Together, we're going to look for the real you." I said, "If I don't know who I am, how do I know who to look for? And even if I find me, how do I know if it's me? Besides, if I want to look for me, what do I need him? I can look myself. Or I can take my friends. We know where I was. Besides, I said to myself, what if I find the real me and I find that he's even worse than me? What do I need him? I don't make enough for myself. I need a partner. 10 years ago, I've been glad to look for anybody. Now I'm doing good. Why should I look for him? He needs help. Let him look for me." He said, "The search for the real you will have to continue. That'll be $100. I said to myself, "This is not the real me. Why should I give him the $100? Now look for the real me. Let him give him the $100.
That is a classic cut from Jackie Mason. So, you know, that's the way psychotherapy was seen in the 50s. When I got in the field, it was late 60s, early 70s. I had no idea that the mind had anything to do with the brain. I think maybe most of us was also that. But what drew you into the field, Tony?
Well, I was a pediatrician, actually, who felt that most of the kids I was treating had problems with behavior and with relationships and with learning, and I realized that I wasn't going to be able to treat them as a pediatrician, so I decided the best way to help them would be to become a child psychiatrist, which led me at that time, fortunately, to learning about family therapy and about, you know, not only therapy but the evolving science of the brain. So it was a good time. It was a changing paradigm, though. It was no longer just psychotherapy versus medication. You know, it was the beginnings, at least, of talking about integrating. And that was really my vision, was we were at the cusp of a beginnings of a new way of thinking about how to help patients.
I guess I was in the wave before that. John F. Kennedy, mm-hmm. a couple of years earlier, yeah. started the Community Mental Health yeah. Center yep. Act. We didn't have CBT. We were just learning behavior therapy, which was a step ahead of Pavlov. I literally gave my inpatients reinforcers
sure.
for their behavior. But it was an exciting time.
Well, the other interesting thing at the time was that hospitalizations were longer than they are now. So residents, you know, which I was at the time, we had a chance to really get to know our patients. And, for example, at the Child Guidance Clinic, there was an apartment for the entire family. So we could watch how they were dealing with each other around the dinner table or what have you. And it was a really exciting time to think about relationships and how we could help people while they were very, very much in crisis. And that's really been a very drastic change in the historical epic that I've seen, you know, in the last 30 years.
Tony, as you say that, I look at your furrowed brow. That mm-hmm. wasn't a happy face when
right.
you said drastic change.
Well, because what began to happen, Dan, was that there was a concern on the one hand that the patients were being kept too long in the hospital. And the progressive side of all that was the deinstitutionalization movement was taking hold. You know, Byberry was being closed. We were saying patients shouldn't stay long-term in hospitals. But a lot of the cuts in lengths of stay were motivated by insurance companies. And really, it was, you know, stay 30 days, then you leave no matter what. And then lately, the average length of stay has really been drastically reduced, you know, 5 days, 6 days. How does that allow a resident who's trying to learn how to take care of patients to really see a course of treatment take effect? So we are still, you know, in this process of trying to shift training from inpatient to community and to outpatient settings, which is a good thing. But I worry that the inpatient, the learning that takes place on the inpatient unit isn't as deep and broad as it used to be.
It's also not long enough to establish safety.
That's right.
For the patient.
That's right. And that's and when I talk to residents, one of the things they're most concerned about is that when we discharge patients maybe too early, the worry that they will, you know, something terrible will happen, even though we're always trying to provide for safety. You know, it's hard to determine when you don't really know the patient that well.
Cecilia, I'm curious about you and what brought you into the field. I mean, you were teaching. You were going for your postdoc at Columbia. What got you into psychiatry?
So it was certainly a circuitous route. But when I was much younger, I was very science-oriented. I was, you know, one of those people who went to space camp 6 times. Mm. And then when I went to undergrad, I really got interested in sort of philosophy, politics, education, literature. And then I came back around, I think, you know, being in education, I saw children who were extremely troubled, children who had a lot of difficulty with social, emotional issues, and really felt drawn more to that than the academic side of education. And so I did a post-bac at NYU to do sort of organic chemistry and then went to medical school at Columbia. And in my first interview there, I said I want to be a child psychiatrist. So I knew right away. And it's sort of the intersection, I think, between the humanities and the sciences and asks the big questions.
Michelle Joy.
I would say my path was dissimilar from Cecilia's, but maybe similar motivations. I would say that one of my first coherent identities was that of a writer from pretty young, poetry and satirical journalism. So I knew that I was interested in narrative and stories. When I was an undergraduate, I took my first neuroscience class, and I had never really thought about the brain. But the possibility that there could be a science behind people and stories really excited me. So right from undergrad, I knew that I wanted to be a psychiatrist. I didn't want to be a doctor. My interest in narrative and, like Cecilia was saying, philosophy, social justice, so many things I felt could combine in the career and identity of a psychiatrist. I took a year off and spent it writing before medical school so that I could keep that part of me alive. And then I went to medical school, kept with the intent of being a psychiatrist, and have enjoyed it all along as I went through any of the other rotations.
Yeah, there was a while where narratives kind of became less important when we discovered the brain and thought all the answers were up there.
Well, I think part of that also is that, for better or for worse, part of training is to learn a nosological system called the DSM, which teaches you that patients' illnesses are a collection of symptoms rather than a trajectory of illness or someone's story.
I remember reading an article, gee, it might have been in the 90s, late 90s, but the article was titled, "We've Discovered the Brain and Lost Our Mind."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is a special edition of Voices in the Family. It's our roundtable conversation about the field of psychiatry and psychology. With me are two residents from University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Cecilia Livesey and Dr. Michelle Joy. Also, we're joined by a seasoned veteran and a dear friend, Dr. Anthony Rostein. He's vice chair of education at the University of Pennsylvania. Cecilia, the research shows that medical students come into medical school filled with energy and ideals, and that lasts about 2 years. And then something about their training kind of cures them of their energy and ideals. So what are your thoughts about what can be done differently, what should be done?
Well, I think part of the difficulty in medical school is the first 2 years is spent mostly in the classroom. So I think one thing that could really make a big difference is introducing medical students to patients a lot earlier. Because I think in the third year, when you go through the clinical rotations and you have those connections with patients and you have those really human experiences where you're, you know, holding someone's hand as they're dying, or you're, you know, seeing a baby being born or something like that. I mean, those are such inspiring experiences that to only focus on, you know, chemistry and neurochemicals in the first 2 years, I think you get a little bit sort of divested from the field, from your passion.
The humanity.
Yeah.
The humans. I have to tell you, I've got one other concern. I mean, you're concerned about things being reduced to the brain in our field. But, you know, in the field of psychotherapy, I'm concerned that things get reduced to techniques, you know, that you really don't have to get to know your patient because we've got these techniques that are tried and tested. Applying a technique is going to change a person. That's a real relationship is troubling to me.
This is Michelle. I would say that a lot of what we're talking about or some of the recurring themes seem to be relationship and the humanities. And intersecting that with our other theme of reimbursement, I think a problem for the entire field of mental health practitioners who provide therapy is that therapy is an art, and an art isn't studyable. You can't study necessarily emotion. You can't necessarily, as well as you can quantitatively, study subjective states or relationships. So when we're talking about reimbursement and the way that the National Institute of Mental Health gives money or the way that our time is reimbursed for, people don't reimburse for art. And what you're really talking about is the art of change over time through a relationship and using emotion. I can't say that I don't find value in some of the behavioral techniques we train in, dialectical behavioral therapy, habit reversal therapy, all different kinds of behavioral or cognitive techniques. But I think that there's a time and a place. And I do hope that we don't lose the value, the emphasis, and the beauty of the art of therapy.
I'm curious, for both of the residents, about gender issues here and how you've experienced them in medical school, in your residency, and your patients. I'd just like to hear you address those issues. We'll start with you, Michelle.
Are you speaking of my gender identity personally or patients' experiences of gender or whatever comes to mind?
Yes.
Okay, the latter. I guess that for me, my intersection between work and gender is more an interest of making patients comfortable in whatever their gender identity or expression might be. So I am helping to lead a quality improvement task force on LGBTQIA comfort within workspaces. I'm starting to work at CHOP soon in a rotation clinic, co-evaluating and supporting youth 5 to 24 in feeling comfortable in their own gender identity expression. And as I said before, I think that one of the places that our field lacked so much over the last decades is in its discrimination toward populations. So when you say gender, what comes to mind for me is helping support minority expressions of gender and sexuality in being who they are and discovering that. And that comes to mind for me more than any experience of my own about gender. And I guess that would make me feel privileged just to say that and make it safe to say that residency, while in some fields may be patriarchal and maybe in some ways our field still is, I felt completely supported being a woman. Our residency class right now at one point was 11 out of 13 identifying as female gender. So I don't think that my personal gender expression has in any way been an obstacle toward my career so far.
Thank you, Michelle. So, Cecilia, I would like to hear you address the issue.
So, personally, I feel like I've been extremely lucky. You know, I think as a woman who had twins in medical school and then a baby in her intern year of residency, gender has been fairly forefront. And I actually remember calling Dr. Rothstein before we found out where we got into residency, and everyone at Columbia, my dean, everyone said, don't tell anyone you're pregnant. I called him and told him, and he was extremely gracious and has made it possible for me to have the sort of work-life balance that I've wanted. And I think that that wouldn't have happened a generation ago. I think women would have been scared to speak up. I think they would have tried to sort of compete in a way with their male colleagues in order to show that they were, you know, able to keep up rather than creating their own space, creating their own work-life balance. And I've felt very fortunate to be in a field, I think psychiatry especially, and at a place like Penn that has supported that.
You're listening to a special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, speaking with Dr. Anthony Rothstein, an advisor to psychiatric residents Dr. Cecilia Livesay and Dr. Michelle Joy, about the past, present, and future of behavioral health. Coming up, the residents turn the tables on Dr. Dan and Dr. Rothstein and ask them how they stay vital and interested over the years. I'm Larry Roebling. We'll be right back with more. Welcome back to this special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. I'm Larry Roebling. Our two seasoned veterans and young up-and-coming Penn residents have been sharing their intergenerational views about the profession. Let's take a listen as Dr. Cecilia Livesay and Dr. Michelle Joy grill the old guys, Dan Gottlieb and Dr. Anthony Rothstein, on a life in psychiatry and psychology.
Have at it, Michelle.
I think one of the things I'm interested in at this point in looking forward to the possibilities, multiple possibilities for my career, is how does someone sustain themselves over time in any one part of psychiatry, even if, or psychology or therapy, even if there's a mix. There's so many possibilities, but my transition between residency and eventually a career looks as more limiting, that I'll be doing in some ways less, not having as many opportunities as I have in residency. So how do you sustain a passion or an interest or a drive over time?
What I think is clearly that your passion is already there, and what you have to do is be sure that you have a good balance between what sort of puts, you know, bread on the table, so to speak, and what really gets you excited every day. And I think that education, for example, and staying involved in some way, and we have a lot of faculty who are out in practice in a variety of settings, and they all admit that one of the most fun things they do is supervise residents or teach medical students, because that relationship itself keeps us going. The second is to really think about areas that you want to learn about that you haven't learned about.
So what you're saying is one of the things, or many of the things that can sustain passion, are some of the same things that bring us to the field in the first place.
Absolutely.
Excitement about learning and teaching and
Absolutely.
Communication.
So, Michelle, I'm going to weigh in. You will get tired. You will experience what you might label burnout. And when you experience that, please be mindful that it just means you're tired. Physically, emotionally, spiritually, maybe all of them. And when you're tired, do for you what you would do for anyone you loved. Take care. Take care of you. You need some time off? Take some time off. You need massages? You need yoga? You need mindfulness meditation? Whatever it takes for you to have your body, mind, and spirit cared for a while. That's critical, because it's going to happen. And, you know, if you can be caring, compassionate towards you throughout, then I think you're going to enjoy not only the field, but more likely to enjoy your life, no matter what you do.
I think that's one of the strengths of our field and our training, as much as the medical profession at times pushes you maybe beyond your limits. It also teaches you, at least within psychiatry and therapy training, to take an honest inventory of yourself, maybe your strengths and your weaknesses, and also kind of when you're getting tired or how your trajectory is going, in sync with your patients, out of sync, and where that future's heading.
At the risk of, well, what we learn and what we do are not always the same. So, you know, I want to turn to you, Cecilia. So, sure. What are your questions?
I have lots of questions, but
one
of my first ones, I guess, is what obstacles did you face that you couldn't have anticipated when you were at our stage of training? And maybe another way to frame it is sort of what realities did you come up against that maybe in sort of a more idealistic youth you didn't realize would be as difficult?
I was thrown into the field, and it is breathtaking how little I knew. I was, quote, the chief psychologist at an old hospital in Southwest Philly, Bercy Douglas Hospital. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was a general hospital. We had a 30-bed locked unit, and there I was, first day. Ink was wet on my diploma, and I was the chief psychiatrist, and my first patient was a woman who had schizophrenia and had carried that diagnosis for 35 years. I was in my 20s. So she had that diagnosis longer than I had been on this planet.
When I would go to a dinner party with my then wife and I said what I did for a living, people were kind of not sure how to respond to me. And then I would also seem to be the target for a lot of either questions that people had for themselves. Oh, really? I could really use it, you know, want to talk to me about their problems there. Or sort of a real hostility towards the field, you know, a sense of, well, you're not really doctors. And that's gotten better, but it's still not, you know, uniformly the case that, you know, you're seen in the social world as someone who's got legitimate knowledge and expertise. And the other, I'd say what was even more surprising was that within my colleagues in medicine, a continuing questioning about, well, why did you leave pediatrics? And, you know, or in your case, it would be, why did you choose psychiatry instead of these other fields? But I would say that I kind of now have accepted the fact that psychiatry always will be somewhat marginalized with respect to the larger enterprise of medicine, because our work is with people who are marginalized by their diseases, by society values. I have to really learn. I was not ready for this. I had to learn to be less helpful in a strange way, be more withholding of my opinion until I understood better what was really going on, because I was in the got to help you mode when I was younger, like, let me tell you what you need to do. And lately I've started to say, now let me understand a little more before I speak up.
I was going to eliminate PhD after my title on my cards, and I was going to put instead DKS, don't know much. it's like a reminder.
Right.
To honor my own ignorance.
Yes.
You know, and
humility.
Yeah, you bring that into every relationships. Yeah. Start off with, I don't know. You know, a curious mind and an open heart. I mean, it kind of changes everything.
Right.
Tony and I have been teachers for many, many years. And I want to put us both in the position of being your students now. And what do we need to learn? What do you have for us? Cecilia?
You know, I think it's very interesting just looking at therapy in general that, you know, therapeutic alliance is the number one predictor of success in any type of therapy, whether that's cognitive or psychodynamic or dialectical. And so this idea that you can learn how to be in a relationship through reading a textbook or anything like that, I think is a little bit absurd. And I think of therapy as more, learning therapy as more of an apprenticeship, and that the only way to do it is through talking with experienced people, with supervisors, with people who have done it over a number of years. And because it is an art form, it is something that you have to see modeled.
So let me ask you, Michelle, what do you have to teach us? What do we need to learn?
Some of the lessons that we can provide are about tolerance and acceptance in new ways and different forms of identity, choices that people make in a postmodern society where accepted of different gender roles, the different gender identities, different sexual identities, and that's something that the field in itself really has to come to understand and learn and distance itself in a way from the past, and I think our generation's ready to teach about that.
Yeah, I do too. In the beginning of our discussion, the one thing I didn't mention that I will now is that homosexuality was still in the Diagnostic mm-hmm. and Statistical Manual, the DSM. So we have changed, and mm-hmm. there's way, way more to go.
I think all four of us have talked a bit about what brought us to the field, what we've seen in mental health, how the field has changed over time. But how do you guys feel that the field has changed you, not as a mental health practitioner, not what you're like with patients, but how has being in mental health in this field changed you as a person when you step outside of the office, when you're at home, when you're doing the things you love or don't love?
I think that's a great question. No one's ever asked that of me. I don't know about you, Tony, but it's changed me profoundly. In many respects, it has saved my life, literally and metaphorically. It has helped me develop a great faith in relationships and the healing power of the human spirit and resilience, yours, theirs, and mine. It's changed me profoundly. I'm more comfortable in my life. It has helped me cultivate the ability for compassion for myself, my loved ones, even for strangers and on rare occasions enemies.
It's interesting when applicants ask me about how I like residency or my career so far. I have said many times that I never really understood the meaning of the word gratitude in almost a spiritual sense until I knew what it was like to have a career that I enjoyed so much, to wake up every day looking forward to what you do and finding meaning in it. I think it's a sacred and holy, valuable place to be. Dr. Rothstein, would you say that it's
changed
you?
I think what the one fundamental way it's changed me is that I've grown deeply appreciative of the people in my life who've supported me in the way I go about my career, meaning that I couldn't do what I do without the people who love me around me, my friends, my family, my kids. You know, in different ways, giving me the message. For example, like, hey, Dad, let's not talk shrink stuff now, you know, and stop being a shrink, you know, and learning to be a human despite all of the ways in which becoming a psychiatrist changes our way of thinking about ourselves and our patients. So that kind of realization that I'm just, you know, outside of the consulting room or where I'm teaching or interacting with everybody, I'm just like everyone else. And I think to me, even though I've always felt that way, the humility that comes of this profession reminds me that, you know, I'm lucky. And that's, so I do feel that sense of gratitude and good fortune. And that so many of the things that I sort of have taken for granted in my life, I can't do that. You know, I have to sort of stop. And so this morning, as an example, in line with that, is I was thinking about coming to the show, and I was outside walking my dog, and it was a beautiful sunrise, and there was a tree against the changing sky, and two planes that were arcing and forming like lines of clouds in the sky. And I just thought, what a beautiful moment. And this is kind of what I think our field teaches us, is we have to help ourselves as much as our patients appreciate the uniqueness of each of our lives, and not trying to be someone else. And I'm thinking about like Horton Hatch's The Who or whatever, you know, it's sort of just, you know, you are who you are, and you have to kind of come to terms with that. And I do think that both my own work in therapy and myself, and also the work I do within my career, is helped me to gain self-acceptance, for which I feel grateful.
Yeah, and even self-compassion.
Yeah, that's a real big one, self-compassion.
Yeah. Cecilia?
Well, you know, I want to echo what you're saying and feeling so fortunate and privileged to be part of this field. And I guess one of the questions I have going forward, looking at my career choices, is, you know, what are the metrics that you would use now to look back at career satisfaction, at career success, of what's made you happy throughout your career, and what's made you be able to give back to patients in the way that you want to give back and love them in the way you want to love them.
I don't know if we can generalize, but I had some profound experiences around my accident. So I was laying in the intensive care, only wishing to die, close my eyes and never wake up. And a nurse came up to me, and I couldn't turn my head to see her because of all the equipment. And she asked if she could talk to me about her life. And she did, and she told me about her great losses. And she didn't know she could have the strength to go on. And all I did was listen in a way I have never listened to another human being in my whole life. It's like I experienced her pain in my body. And, you know, at the end, you know, I referred her to a therapist, and she thanked me. And I closed my eyes, and I said, I can live with this. Knowing that I had the wherewithal to be able to help another human being. So, you know, that doesn't answer your question about metrics, but my ability to help another human being, even if sitting with someone in a sacred space, a safe place, having the faith that that process alone, that safety and compassion alone can begin the healing process, and very often might be all that's needed for the healing process, because I have learned that, you know, minds, brains, like bodies, you know, tend to heal on their own if everything is safe around. So that's my metric.
It's a great metric.
Coming up next, our studio audience joins the conversation, asking questions about new methods of treatment and the effects of social media and gun violence in our communities. I'm Larry Roebling, and we'll be right back with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. Welcome back. I'm Larry Roebling. Our studio audience at this Voices in the Family special was anxious to chime in with their questions to our veteran clinicians and residents, Dr. Dan, Dr. Anthony Rothstein, Dr. Cecilia Livesey, and Dr. Michelle Joy. And they had some challenging ones.
My name's Tyler. My question's for everybody, but it was about something Michelle brought up about the power of the recovery movement and the delivery of peer services and peer mentoring services. Because this is such a new ideology and function across the behavioral health field, if you could speak to the importance of those services a little bit more, it'd be much appreciated.
I would say it's new, but it's also not new. I think that we're giving it a new name and a new political motivation. But it springs out of decades ago, actually civil rights movements. The recovery movement comes from saying that people with mental health difficulties were, I don't want to say last, but one of the remaining groups that did not have full kind of encompassment of their civil rights. So back a couple of decades ago, we might have called similar techniques and methodologies psychosocial rehabilitation, and they may have lost steam over time. I think in some ways, it's new to psychiatrists. And it's new maybe to psychologists, but I think social work, psychosocial rehabilitation, and peer support has been there in some ways. 12-step programs, I mean, that's almost the model of peer support and narrative telling. What the question brings up, though, is how are we going to integrate it, A, into a field where doctors, both psychologists and psychiatrists, think that they have the authority and know everything that's right, and B, that scary word, reimbursement. And I think one lens into the way that we can do this is focusing more on quality of life. We're going to need metrics for better or for worse. That's how things are going to be reimbursed, and that's how people are going to get money. But instead of focusing on, did this person take their medication? How sad was their sadness? Can we talk about, how did we get them to achieve their goals? Did they want relationships? Did they not want relationships? Did they want to work? And I think that peer support will add a special value to that. And I think that the way we can see that value is through evaluating quality of life and helping people achieve their goals.
There's something about being with kindred spirits that enables you to drop your shoulders, literally and metaphorically, and go,
Most definitely. And so much of at least historical training for psychotherapists was to remain removed from the patient and not to give any of your own past and history into the therapeutic relationship. But I think in some ways we're even gently lending parts of ourselves to the relationship more than maybe previous generations did before. And I think that's also a way to talk about shared narrative and support.
This idea of peers and the role of peers in promoting health and in facilitating transition, say, from hospital to outpatient. And I think that that's the cutting edge, if you will, of this of the ACA, because actually integrated care is designed to get systems to think about reducing rehospitalization. And the best way to do that is not to rely just on medical or expert, but also to identify who are the community peer supports that can promote healthy, you know, healthy living and improve functional outcomes.
Cecilia, you have any comments about?
Well, I think one area of, or one institution that's actually very good on peer support, which we rotate through, is the VA hospital. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very much not necessarily about the shared mental health experience, but about the shared experience in wartime. And I think that's something that increasingly is happening in the field as the body of psychiatrists and mental health professionals becomes more diverse. I think that people can be paired with people who have some shared experience, and it doesn't always have to necessarily be a peer-to-peer relationship, but just having people who've gone through the same things or who are the same gender or who have had the same experiences of being marginalized for whatever reason they've been marginalized. And I think a lot of the recovery movement is about saying, no, we won't be marginalized. And I think that is incredibly empowering to patients.
That's great. Our next question, comment?
Hi, my name is John. I remember an expression, Dan, you said many years ago on the radio that you and maybe other psychotherapists became psychotherapists because you needed more help than you could possibly afford. And I'm familiar with a Roman Catholic writer, Henry Nouwen, a priest who's deceased now, who liked to say about pastoral work that one needed to be a wounded healer. And so I'd like to tease out a little bit more the beauty of this therapeutic work, not just technique, but from the perspective of the ones who need the help, especially themselves, and ones who recognize that they are wounded healers.
Thank you so much for that question. I guess we start with you, Tony.
Okay. Look, I appreciate where you're coming from with that question, and I will disclose the fact that, you know, as I grew up, my parents were divorced when I was young, and I managed to deal with a complicated family system, taking care of my younger sister and doing well in school and always trying to help others. But I realized by the time I got to college that I was working really hard to look like I was fine, and in fact, I wasn't. And I actually got depressed and took a year off from college, and was a year that changed my life. I began my own psychotherapy, and I found a meaning and discovered the joy of working with kids, returned to college with the mission of being a teacher, and then eventually decided to become a pediatrician, and then eventually a psychiatrist. And I think all of the links to that had to do with my growing understanding that I myself wasn't going to be happy unless I was helping people figure things out at the deepest level that I could reach them in.
I'm also curious about these residents and how you would address the issue of the wounded healer, if you're comfortable doing so. I'll start with you, Cecilia.
Well, I think, one thing that every patient comes to a provider where they say, am I going to feel understood? And I guess I feel that every sort of negative experience that I've had in my life can be translated into a positive in the sense of the wounded healer by, that shared experience. So, even having children is an experience that I feel I can now connect with my patients about. My mother died. I feel that I understand people who lost a parent at a relatively young age. I had a friend who, died in 9/11, and I've had various other losses. I've had a few major surgeries recently, a few health issues. And I feel like every time something major happens in my own life that is difficult and painful, it just helps me connect with my patients and understand sort of the trials and tribulations that they're going through as well. And it helps me become a better doctor and psychiatrist.
I would say two themes struck me as I was listening to the question by the audience member, not only that of the wounded healer, but the connection to art. And earlier on in our conversation, I had spoken about myself, maybe my first coherent identity as being that of a writer. My own background is one of my family with a lot of addiction and poverty, some violence, incarceration. My brother, my role model, got shot when we were younger, and I saw that completely turn his life around in a positive way. And he learned so much about himself through that experience. And I processed all of these experiences through writing, mainly through poetry. As I said, my kind of path to psychiatry itself was one of narrative. And not only do I value narrative and stories with my patients in the office and as a way of healing on an individual level, I also continue to write. So I often say that my main job is helping people tell their own stories. So I was an editor for a humanities journal collecting stories of patients, doctors, and their family members. Right now I'm working on a book about stories of psychosis, helping people tell their narratives of different experiences of psychosis they've had. I just published, or a paper is coming out, about the experience of African-American caregivers of individuals with schizophrenia. So really that question drove straight to the core of what I see as important, both in art and in healing, which is this transformative process of narrative.
Anybody else have any questions, comments?
Hi, I'm Lisa. I just have to express an overwhelming gratitude to be here with Dr. Dan, who is a national treasure we're lucky to have in Philadelphia, and to be here with all of you. It's a privilege to be able to listen into this fascinating conversation, and most importantly, to see the bright and inspiring future faces of psychiatry and their teachers. It's really a delight. I'm curious about being hyper-connected through social media. There is such a change in how people share about their lives, how comfortable I can see my sons are with transparency and exposition in a different way that I have an understanding of public and private. And I wonder, when we think about social media, and then we think about the way moments that were very critical in life were celebrated or honored in the home, where there would be a birth or a death feet from the kitchen table. And now we have a moment on Facebook that is publicized to the world in a nanosecond. And I'm wondering if you would be able to speak to whether you think psychiatry in the field will be impacted by that, because your work happens in those quiet, private, very deep personal moments of intimate connection in small spaces, as opposed to cyberspace.
Well, I think that's an excellent question. And you know, I think what my hope is that we can hold up sort of the duality of those two ideas and keep both in mind. And so I think these private, quiet, intense, personal moments between two people or between a family are incredibly important. At the same time, I think the way that the world is going, the transparency, the openness, the sharing of emotion, the sharing of experience, these things help people feel less isolated. These people help people see that other people are going through the same things that they are. And of course, a lot has been written about the you know, destructive nature, I think, of the internet and social media and things like that. But I see it as a joining force and a powerful force in ways that youth can connect, in ways that youth can see that they're not alone, and in ways that people can share their stories and almost add to a larger narrative, to a societal narrative.
My name is Keith. I'm a lay member here. The whole issue of gun control seems to have put mental health on the front page. I'm just being a member of the public. I'm wondering how, again, given the impatience of the general public for solutions, how your industry is geared to respond to the limelight that you're going to be receiving over the next few months and a few years, perhaps.
So given the nature of that question, and thank you, I want to first turn to Michelle.
It's extremely positive that we now have $500 million new dollars that it will be directed to mental health care because of violence. However, it inextricably links mental health difficulties, and suffering with violence. I'm concerned but hopeful. I'm glad that it might bring more attention and more resources and more thoughtfulness, but I think more than ever we have to be aware of the linkage and the stigma that mental illness has, and particularly with violence. We talk all the time in the field about the two facts. One, that people with mental health difficulties are more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators. It's one of our sound bites. And the other being that only substance abuse and intoxication can in any way predict an impulsive momentary act of violence. So I think that when the ACA was passed originally, Obama made an executive order to remove the ban that the CDC had on not funding information and studies about gun violence. I think that now that that ban is lifted, we are going to have to actually invest money and research into studying violence separate from mental health, looking at what violence is, but apart from mental illness, looking at what factors actually contribute to violence, contribute to death, contribute to all of these things that make the headlines, and keep it separate when it needs to be, linked when it needs to be, but understand that it's very often not linked.
My fear, my wish is how to get research, real data, into the hands and the minds of those big decisions. You know, when I had someone once told me, I'll never forget the quote. He said, "I wouldn't believe that even if it was true." So where do you go with
that? At least that's honesty.
Yeah.
And Tony? I do think that what Michelle just talked about, which is the re-stigmatization of the mentally ill with this latest wave of discussions, is something to watch out for. But in line with what you just said, having access to guns, if you're unstable emotionally in any state, whether it's from a mental illness or from the acute experience of rage that, or from drugs or what have you, that it's the access to guns and the easy way in which those get discharged, and, you know, same with suicide. We know that guns are a hugely much more fatal approach to suicide than any other. So I hope that that will come out of this, that people will talk about the all too easy access to guns that can lead to tragic outcomes. And not to turn it around and say, and therefore we have to jail everybody who's mentally ill. You see, that's the fear, is that somehow people will become less empathic towards those with mental illness, as opposed to getting us all to be understanding of it and also getting people into treatment. And that would be a very positive outcome. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, most mentally ill people are not violent, and most violent crimes are not perpetrated by mentally ill people. But I think this is an opportunity to really focus on prevention and early intervention. I mean, when you look at Adam Lanza and the Sandy Hook shooting, I mean, he hadn't left his room in 3 months. He was 112 pounds, even though he was over 6 feet. And there were so many early warning signs that were missed because teachers weren't properly trained, because the people, you know, his mother hadn't noticed the signs. And so I think the more we can get information out there and destigmatize just even the kind of acknowledgement that teens may be troubled. And I also think an interesting point about the violence is that, you know, some of the recent shootings, which have been either politically motivated or racially motivated, or in the case of the married couple in San Bernardino, California, possibly Islamic jihad motivation, as authorities have said. I mean, it's hard to separate whether, you know, mental illness is involved in all of these, even though the media has said that. And so I am worried about that everyone just groups everyone together in this sort of mentally ill, violent bucket. And in fact, there are all sorts of environmental and political and other motivations.
Now that we are just about out of time, I want to thank our studio audience for coming out and sharing those really interesting and provocative questions. And the three of you, you have been wonderful. I loved our discussion, your questions, and I feel much better about the future of our field. So thank all three of you so much.
Thank you.
This has been the first of six Voices in the Family specials with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. His guests were Dr. Anthony Rothstein, Dr. Cecilia Livesay, and Dr. Michelle Joy. The next Voices in the Family special airs in March, and if you'd like to be part of our live audience taping, keep an eye on the WHYY events page for more information. I'm Larry Roebling, producer of Voices in the Family. You can follow Dr. Dan on Twitter at Voices in the Fam. Email us at voices@whyy.org. The engineers for today's show were Al Banks and Charlie Kyer. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is WHYY's executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is Voices executive producer. And until the next Voices special, Dr. Dan says, have a great couple of weeks, my friends.